We are right here along Radio Row at the CPAC conference up in Washington, D.C., and it's my pleasure to welcome to your turn Colin Hanna. He is the President and Executive Director of Let Freedom Ring, a nonprofit public policy organization. Thank you so much, Mr. Hanna, for joining us.
Please call me Colin, and thank you, Renee. Good to be with you.
Tell us a little bit about Let Freedom Ring for the folks who don't know about the organization.
Sure. We're a classic conservative organization with a three-pronged mission statement. We support constitutional government, economic freedom, and traditional values. So that has us involved in everything from separation of powers, selection of Supreme Court justices that are originalists, to tax reform, Social Security reform, support for the free enterprise system, low taxes in general, etc., all the way to such cultural issues as pro-life, pro-family positions, support for the original intention of the First Amendment, for instance, with regard to religious liberty, the notion that the founders certainly never intended God to be absent from the public square, just that government should not interfere with the operation of churches, things like that. We've also gotten involved in the immigration issue in a big way through one of our projects called WeNeedAfence.com, and we've been involved in the jihadism awareness movement with another freestanding website called TheirOwnWords.com. And what that does is present to the average American the translated words of jihadists in the Middle East when they think we're not paying attention, not when they put on their best face and sound all sorts of moderate before the CNN microphones or something like that, but when they are actually stoking the fires of hatred among their own people. And there are people in this country, Renee, who are naive to the point of danger, and they believe that if we were just nicer to these terrorists, somehow they'd be nicer to us. And if you see speech after speech, whether it's on television or a public speech, from these merchants of hatred, you can no longer hold to that naive notion that if we were just nicer to them, they'd be nicer to us. So we don't call for any particular policy. We don't call for armed intervention in Iran, for instance, or anything like that. We're all about promoting awareness to shake America free from its either lethargy or naivete when it comes to the intentions of these folks. So those are just some of the issues that we're involved in. We're also involved in healthcare reform, and I'm co-chairing a panel here at CPAC on conservative alternatives to liberal healthcare reform and things of that nature. So there are quite a few themes that are important to conservatives that we touch. LetFreedomRingUSA.com is our home website, and then those other project websites come off of that.
Well, we have lots of things that I want to talk about. I've been feverishly writing down notes because you've hit a lot of different points. First of all, let me welcome you back to your turn. And when you mentioned your project, WeNeedAfence.com,
right,
about a year and a half, or maybe it's been almost 2 years ago, you came on our program,
right,
remotely. So
yes,
let
yes.
me welcome you back to your turn with
thank
your efforts.
You. When we started with you, the idea of a fence was really relegated to the fringes of the immigration debate and the not altogether respectable fringe. And in fact, I think that we moved to advance that issue to the center. And without ever a tinge of racism or xenophobia, we're talking about the importance from a national security standpoint, from a drug and human trafficking standpoint, from a public health standpoint, how absolutely critical it is that a fence be part of a coordinated effort to secure the border, not to close the border. And we always say that we want a real fence and a real gate. We're not in any sense opposed to legal immigration. It's illegal immigration that we want to see stopped. And you cannot secure the border without physical infrastructure. There are three elements that are necessary to secure the border. You must have physical infrastructure, you must have adequate manpower, and you ought to have technology, because that makes it possible to multiply the effectiveness of both your technology and your infrastructure. Exactly. Go light on any one of those three, and you will fail to secure the border. So we never say that a fence is all that is needed, but we do say that you cannot secure the border without physical infrastructure in place.
Well, we're talking on the campaign trail. Everyone, it seems, you know, rightfully so, the focus has been the economy and the war in Iraq. why is immigration so far down that list, and how can we push it back up?
Well,
because doesn't that obviously significantly impact those two main issues that's on everybody's mind?
Of course it does. The economic impact of illegal immigration is huge. And it's much more widespread than the average person realizes. From a standpoint of workers, it not only takes away jobs, but it also depresses wages. There are some who think that conservatives, because they tend to be pro-business, will automatically embrace the notion of the cheapest possible labor. Well, I don't think that most business owners that I know, that I've worked with, have such an amoral view towards the relationship between workers and their employer. I think it's important that people get a fair wage for the work, which they do. And most employers that I know would rather have reliable, committed, educated workers, even if they must pay them somewhat more, than people of questionable legality with the possibility that they might disappear at any moment without any notice, and that undermine the opportunities for employment for Americans. And this notion that they all do the work that Americans won't do is a flawed notion. It's not entirely wrong, but it's largely wrong, because most of those jobs are jobs that Americans won't do at the lowest possible wage, in many cases lower than the legal minimum wage. But many of those jobs are jobs that Americans will gladly do. And time after time, when there has been a case of a large number of illegal immigrants being dismissed from a company because they were in fact illegal, you'll find that there are a large number of Americans who apply for the job openings that they create.
Right, lined right up there.
Absolutely.
We're talking with Colin Hanna. He's the president of Let Freedom Ring. Is it a membership organization?
It is a membership organization, but without fee, an unusual membership organization in that respect. You may join Let Freedom Ring, and one of the benefits of joining is that you have an opportunity to elect one of our board of directors. Each year, one board member is elected from our membership. So we are a membership organization. There is an opportunity to sign up for emails and regular alerts and so on, but we don't charge a fee.
One of the very interesting projects that you have is theirownwords.com, a jihadist awareness website. And like you said earlier on, a lot of this is about awareness. It's making sure that people are aware what our enemies are saying about us, and that we can't just, as you said, play nice with them. Earlier today, Vice President Cheney spoke, and he questioned whether or not Americans have forgotten the lessons of 9/11. Could you comment on that, please?
I didn't actually hear the Vice President's speech because the one person in our system who outranks the Vice President, I was listening to at another location.
Yeah, I heard you were on location at the White House,
right,
but I wasn't going
right.
to disclose that, and I wasn't going to ask you what you were doing, at least not on the air.
No.
But nonetheless,
fine.
I mean...
So I didn't hear the speech, but I think the point that he probably made was that sometimes Americans have short memories, and they tend to let down their guard about some of the threats that we face. And the way to face jihadism is with a strong military and a commitment to freedom and a willingness to deploy military means when necessary in order to defend the interests of the United States. And right now in this presidential election, we're looking at two candidates on the Democrat side of the aisle that seem to be, if anything, not interested in really using the military to help secure America's freedom. So I think that's what the Vice President was probably getting at.
One of the other things that he talked about, and again, I know you're at a little disadvantage because you didn't attend, but I'm just curious how this, from your perspective, the work that you do with Let Freedom Ring, you could help me better understand. He said the absence of another 9/11 is not an accident. It is an achievement.
Oh, I think that's a great point. I think almost everyone, right after 9/11, after having absorbed the horror of that tragedy, asked himself or herself, what's next? What could happen next? If they were able to fly buildings into, I mean, planes into buildings in New York and planes into the Pentagon. What will they do next? And there were all sorts of concerns about suitcase bombs and the possibility of getting into the public water supply. And then it was not long after that 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 train was blown up in Madrid. And then the question was, will they come after our transportation systems? And then there was a concern about whether they might try an attack on a stadium where you have a large number of people in one location, fairly well exposed, fairly vulnerable. And there was a sense of alertness that I think most Americans perceived, and they struggled with the question of how do we preserve our liberty and act in full exercise of freedom rather than cowering in a way that almost gives the other side the victory. But they were alert to the danger, and the fact that there have been no successful attacks since then, I think, has resulted in some people's guard being let down. And I don't know for sure how many potential attacks have been thwarted, but we know of a half a dozen or so that have become public. The one with the shoe bomber, the issue about the assembled components in the restroom on the flight from London that resulted in everyone having to put their cosmetics in a 1-quart Ziploc bag and so on. All of those were very, very close calls, mm-hmm. and successfully avoided. And in most cases avoided because of the measures which the Bush administration put into place, whether it's through the Transportation Security Administration or the Department of Homeland Security. And I think that it's perfectly appropriate for the Vice President, on behalf of the President, to claim a certain amount of credit and thereby to call it an achievement, not just an accident.
You know, at these times, obviously, every presidential year when we're electing a president, everyone's looking forward to November. And they're talking about, the next president and who that will be and what position they will take. I want to look backwards a little bit, please. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that Let Freedom Ring basically stands on three prongs, and that is the Constitution, the economy, and traditional values. Can you give us a report card on this administration on those issues from your perspective?
Well, the constitutional issue that, in some senses, I think will rank highest as an achievement of the administration, and in terms of tenure, long lastingness, will be most important, are probably those two Supreme Court nominations, and the commitment to the original intent of the Constitution, which those two justices stand for, I think are cardinal among their achievements. And therefore, any report card ought to give the administration an A there. There are some other constitutional issues. I think that the Supreme Court's Kelo decision on the use of eminent domain was badly flawed, and I think that the administration could have actually challenged that more effectively than they did. So on that constitutional front, perhaps they don't deserve an A. On the whole separation of powers issue of resisting judicial activism, I think the administration's done fairly well. On the economic freedom issue, the tax cuts, I think, were helpful. The failure to adequately reform and secure the funding base for Social Security, I think, is probably black mark. I thought that the president staked a lot on that in 2004, right after he was reelected. January speech from his inauguration for the second term made it clear that he was going to make a major effort with regard to Social Security, and he botched it.
Yeah, I think didn't he remind us in this year's State of the Union address that that's something we've got to, I mean, I think it's still on the radar screen.
Well, it's on the radar screen, but the point is that 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 they that they botched the way they went about it trying to achieve the reform. And as the president said at the start of his second term, I have some political capital and I'm going to spend it. Well, I think he squandered it rather than spending it. And certainly on the immigration debate, this administration does not deserve high marks. The embrace of what the public perceived to be amnesty was fatal. And I don't think that the immigration debate really needs to be as either difficult or as polarizing as it has turned out to be. I think that the American people would accept a very simple formulation that consists of 2 points. Let's eliminate or vastly reduce illegal immigration, and let's increase legal immigration. If it's clear that our economy needs more workers than we provide, then let's provide a means, let's accelerate, let's streamline the process, but let's bring people here who are motivated not only by opportunism, but also by idealism. And that's what you don't get when you have the open back door to illegal immigration.
You mean folks who are not willing to assimilate?
Absolutely.
Right.
To commit themselves to come here to join American society, working being part of that, rather than people who are just trying to exploit the system, send money back home, never really connect, stay in little ghettos of their own making. That's not healthy. And if you look at the problems that France has had absorbing some of their immigration, you see the cultural damage that can come as a result of failure to assimilate. So I think we ought to welcome people to this country who have the skills that our economy needs and who are committed to the ideals of America. Those people should be welcomed and will become good Americans in time, and our culture will be enriched by the cultures and the ethnic backgrounds which they bring into our mix. That's the right answer, and it really only consists of 2 elements. Let's eliminate illegal immigration. Let's increase legal immigration. It's as simple as that. The president, unfortunately, turned it around backwards in a way that looked like he was unconcerned about illegal immigration and wanted to legalize people that a lot of Americans thought were lawbreakers. It was completely upside down and backwards. So
maybe
on that, he gets an F.
Maybe we need to rethink what the melting pot really means. I mean, people talk about, well, you know, we're a country, we're a melting pot. We're a melting pot because we joined together, we melded together, we assimilated.
Right, absolutely.
Much different than...
And this is one of the few nations in which you can come from any cultural background and genuinely become an American.
Mm-hmm.
You can come from anywhere and become an American. I speak a bit of French. I could move to France. I could even become a French citizen. But there is no way I could ever become a Frenchman. You can become an American. That's the great strength. That's the tremendous distinguishing factor of our great nation, and that is comprised of a number of ideals, and those are the ideals that we ought to be looking for in the people we open our door to. And then if you want to talk for just a moment about one of the traditional values issues, such as abortion, in the context of the immigration debate, or even in the context of the economic debate, let's not forget that one of the reasons why our economy needs more workers than it provides is that we have permitted the slaughter of roughly 45 million babies over the 30 years since Roe versus Wade. Well, just do the math on that. How many of those, if it were a straight line increase, would have been of working age? Roughly 20, 22 million. And how many illegal immigrants has our economy absorbed? Somewhere in the vicinity of 12 to 20 million. Isn't it curious how close those two numbers are?
I'd never heard that statistic. That's amazing. That truly is, leaves you thinking.
Well, it does. There is an interconnectedness to all of these issues. They're not simply three prongs of a platform or three prongs of an independent organization like ours. There really is an interconnectedness.
Well, there definitely is. I mean, you've walked us through all of that. How important, when we talked about the Constitution, you mentioned judicial appointments. This presidency may present itself, the next president, to be one of the most important in terms of judicial appointments.
Absolutely. And I suspect that whichever party wins the presidency, there will be an increased awareness of the importance of appointing younger judges, and therefore how long the appointment can last. And I don't think that we're likely to see appointment of 65 and 70-year-old justices. I think we're going to see a lot of judicial appointments in the...
More Roberts, more Alito.
Yeah, exactly, exactly right.
Their generation.
So there will be between two and four appointments. Justice Ginsburg is 74.
Justice Stevens is
80...
84, I think. 87?
83, I think. I think it's 83 and 74. It might even be 81 and 74. But I'm sorry that I'm a little vague on that. But in any case, there are four justices over 68. Mm-hmm. In fact, there are two at 71. Scalia and I guess Kennedy is 71. In any case, there are four over 71. And the great likelihood is that at least two of those will be replaced, and replaced by probably somebody who will serve on the court for 20 to 30 years. Those are critically important decisions, and when someone looks at who to support, they need to look down the road. One of the great problems of an election season that has been framed in terms of change is that you can easily embrace empty-headed change, just the notion of trying to do something different. And I think it's important that we look at the long-term consequences of change. And nowhere is that more apparent than on the Supreme Court.
On the Supreme Court, you're absolutely right. Change just for change. Well, I want to make sure we have a couple minutes to talk about an issue that's near and dear to my heart and yours as well, and that is health care.
Sure.
You're going to be on a panel, I think, tomorrow, is it?
That's right.
And what's the topic of the panel, health care?
Conservative alternatives to health care reform. And the issue really is, who controls health care? If we want to expand the coverage of health insurance as a means to improve the health care of average Americans, and I think that there's fairly broad support for that, then we have to determine which kind of health care reform we're going to have. Are we going to have health care that is largely government-run, or are we going to have health care that is patient-controlled, patient-driven, doctor-centered? And I think that both Senator Obama's and Senator Clinton's plans are more likely to be government-run. I also think it's important that the conservative movement begin to reframe the debate on health care reform from what it has been. Too often it has been the left saying we want to provide universal, i.e. free health care, and the right saying, oh, don't you realize how expensive that is? Well, you can't beat free with it's too expensive. That's not likely to win the middle of America, which is where this question is going to turn. But I do think that you can beat government-controlled with patient-controlled. So I think that's where the focus ought to be.
So it's a matter of jargon almost.
Well, it's not a matter of... No, it's really... it's a matter of perspective. The left tends to embrace social solutions that are statist. The right sometimes denigrates that as the nanny state, and that's not a bad term. It's about right. But the notion that we give up personal liberty in order to achieve some measure of protection is the very foundation of left-leaning political philosophy. And I think that the right, in every sense, whether it's economic policy, military policy, or social policy, tends to uphold the individual concepts of freedom and the notion of accountability, individual accountability, taking responsibility for oneself. So I think that those principles, if you apply them to health care, lead you in the direction of perhaps providing insurance alternatives for preventative care, for instance. They may not provide coverage for all kinds of exotic elective surgery. 15, 20, 30 years ago, if somebody ripped an ACL in sports, they would learn how to live with the occasional pain and inconvenience that causes. Now everyone has to have a knee replacement. Just use that as a simple and trivial example. So I think that there are things in terms of basic health care that perhaps can be provided without going all the way to the most exotic solutions. There are also enormous inefficiencies in the current system and some of its government control. For instance, most people know that the uninsured often seek medical care through the emergency rooms of hospitals. That is some of the most expensive care possible. And in many cases, the uninsured can't pay. And therefore, either the hospital absorbs the cost as part of its cost of operation, its commitment to the community,
or the government
pays the hospital something called disproportionate share payments. And disproportionate share says that the average hospital ought to expect that it does a certain amount of things for free, but if you happen to be in an area where there are a lot of uninsured, then you might be receiving a disproportionate share of that free care, and there ought to be reimbursement for that. Well, those reimbursements are, the costs which are being reimbursed are so high that the reimbursements themselves are high. So one of the things that Governor Romney did in constructing his health care plan in Massachusetts, which by no means is perfect, but of course he had to also get it through the Massachusetts state legislature, which was its own challenge. But he was able to take some of those disproportionate share payments and redeploy them so that they're available for premium to cover or to subsidize the cost of covering previously uninsured persons. That makes a whole lot more sense than just doling out disproportionate share dollars to hospitals.
Sure does. Let me go back to the interconnectedness then. If we have an effective fence,
yes.
We build the fence that we need to build, the three-part that we talked about.
And its gate.
And its gate. Okay, I'll let you have the gate. How is that going to impact our health care costs? Has the math been done on that? I mean, the tremendous expense of illegal immigrants on our health care system?
Well, sure, because among other things, you're going to have legal employees, which means that you're going to have legal employee benefits paid. And among those employee benefits are typically some kind of health insurance, so you'll have that. Another thing that will happen with a well-monitored gate is that you'll be checking people for health problems. You know, back in the days of Ellis Island, when the largest number of, proportionately, the largest number of immigrants ever came into American society, the single largest reason why people were turned back at Ellis Island was not because of things like criminal records, it was because of health problems. If there were to be a serious endemic, something like the bird flu scare of a couple of years ago, we could have a serious problem associated with communicable diseases coming in through illegal immigrants. And I'm not suggesting for a moment that there's any bad will on their part. In most cases, they've never had access to adequate health care. They can be carrying communicable diseases and be utterly unaware of it. So I'm not suggesting that they're coming to this country in order to freeload off our health care system or to infect America or anything like that. But the fact of the matter is, if another serious worldwide endemic occurs, we have a huge vulnerability with millions of people coming into this country without having any idea of the state of their health care. So fixing the illegal immigration problem will definitely have an impact on health care, not only from the standpoint of employee benefits providing some kind of health insurance, but also from a standpoint of public health itself.
Okay. Well, very good, Colin. Hannah, thank you so much for your time today. The organization is called Let Freedom Ring. Your website, let me have you give that out again. I thought I wrote it down, but I don't have it written down.
It is letfreedomringusa.com.
letfreedomringusa, add that USA at the end, .com. You can learn more about the work that Let Freedom Ring is doing on our behalf on all sorts of issues, certainly the very good work that they're doing on the immigration issue with We Need Our Fence, and they're helping to educate us on the conservative approach to health care reform. And we appreciate your time this afternoon and all of your efforts every day. Thank you so
Thanks
much.
Thanks, Renee. Appreciate it. You've got a great show, too. I wish you the best.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.